Alright, Henry, welcome to the first episode of the Absolute Gentleman podcast. It's an honour to have you here. I think you've got one of the most amazing stories. It's just a crazy, crazy story. It's insane to think that it happened here in South Australia. This is a book about you for the viewers that have heard about Henry Keogh. Thank you so much for coming in today. And like I said to you, you know, let's just have a chat about, you know, I'm just really curious to hear about your experiences and your thoughts, and you've had a crazy life, you've had a hell of a life. Do you just want to maybe just introduce, do you want to give a bit of a backstory, or do you want me
to? Well, you hit off, and if you miss anything, I'll fill in.
I'll just say really that, you know, you were basically wrongfully convicted. Yep. And you went to prison for a long time.
Yep. Nearly 21 years.
Nearly 21 years. You were in prison for 21 years. You changed, your case was part of the reason why the appeal system in South Australia changed. We've got we have unlimited appeal rights here in Australia, in South Australia. You know, your case basically touches on every aspect of criminal justice in South Australia. And that's really as much as, you know, as much as I feel the right, you know, that's as much as I can say to introduce it. And you know, you've got prison stories. I've met you before, you know, just before we got on camera, you were saying that you were making alcohol in prison.
So I've had a very full experience set, I tell you what, and I developed skills that I never thought I would or would have to draw on. But they came along, and they came along at probably just about the right time.
Yeah, like alcohol making.
Pretty much. I mean, look, nothing in jail is exciting unless you make it so. It is tedious, it is boring. You can find yourself locked up in a cell anywhere between 12 and 18 hours a day, sometimes more, and that's it. Nothing happens from...
Is that in all the prisons? Is that in...
Pretty much it can be, because every jail has got different divisions. They've got like a very low security, medium security, and a kind of a high security. And the regime that operates in each of those divisions will be very, very different. So for instance, if you're in high, you'll find yourself locked up between 15 and 20 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Is that where you were? Because you were convicted of murder, right?
But it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't, that's
no,
not.
Because what you'll find is, unless you're on protection versus mainstream, where you are is a factor of where your house is a factor of how much time you have left to serve, your behaviour. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you don't mess up and if you don't sort of buck too many rules, don't get involved in too many fights, don't get caught with contraband and all that sort of stuff, then you will sail through the system and you'll find yourself progressively downgraded in security, in your security rating, and therefore that means you have more liberty, more better access to facilities like education, exercise yard, hobbies and that sort of thing. But if you are a continual mess up, you'll find that.
And which were you? Which were you?
I was the first one to start with.
Really? Were you getting into trouble?
A bit like Andy Dufresne in Shawshank Redemption. I had to go to jail to become a criminal.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what they say. They say that. They say, you know, people go into jail as students come out with a master's degree. Yeah. They go into jail with a bachelor's degree in crime and come out with a master's degree in crime.
They can do.
Well, that's where all the criminals are, right? Like where I was.
When you first get thrown into an environment that you know nothing about,
is it scary?
Other than say maybe TV or movies or maybe a bit of reading, you don't know what to expect.
Yeah.
You expect it's going to be full of tension, violence, and all that sort of stuff.
That's what I would think.
Well, it's what I did, and consequently, I knew enough to say, look, okay, I'm going to keep my eyes and my ears open, and my mouth shut.
Yeah, smart.
Because that way, you are less likely to get yourself into trouble, and it seemed to be working for you. And you know, it's really only as you go along that you suddenly realise that the people that you're in there with, they're not these one-eyebrowed monsters with no neck and gravel rash, and all they know is violence. They most of them are somebody's son, father, brother, mate who have either been in the wrong place at the wrong time or made really bad decisions, or as I did, you know, to make a couple of bad decisions which aren't necessarily that dramatic, but then all of a sudden you get caught up in the juggernaut of the law and it just rolls and rolls until you get ground up.
Yeah.
And what I can tell you this now, once the system gets hold of you, it won't let you go until it gets a result. And the result it got with me and with a number of others is that you get rolled. It doesn't. The system doesn't like to admit that it made mistakes or that it can make mistakes.
Mm.
And
well, they didn't let you off. Like, you know, I mean, for the listeners that sort of, I guess that would be a good time to touch about, you know, the forensic yeah. the forensic expert in your case. What was his name? The
Colin Manock.
Colin Manock.
Manock.
Manock, right? Yeah, Dr. Manock. Doctor is a strong word, though, and you know, it was thousands of cases that he testified in.
He did 10,000 autopsies, and
sorry, Fabod, would you? I just saw a coffee got delivered. I'll give us some. Give us some talk.
Got to stay refreshed.
I'll give us some talk, juice. Okay.
Thank
you so much.
And the thing is, if you're going to have someone who's ostensibly an expert, they've actually got to be qualified. Well, this guy wasn't. It'd be like getting an engineer's report on a bridge or a building from a house painter. That's essentially what this guy was. He was just a general practitioner, and he had launched himself into forensics.
Yep.
He basically had forged or fabricated his qualifications and his experiences from his time in England. When he applied for a position over here, they took him on board. And
he fabricated?
Yeah, well, he, and I've read his CVs, I've read his applications, and within three different applications for the position over here, the number of autopsies that he had performed for the local county that he was operating in England jumped something like 400 times in terms of the numbers of cases. So he would have been doing, he jumped from, say, something like two autopsies a day to 10. I mean, it's physically impossible.
Of course.
And so, but
I would imagine so.
But no one bothered to check it.
Yeah.
And so once he had been taken on board here, they discovered that, well, actually, this guy isn't exactly what he claims to be. And he can't operate a microscope. He can't look at tissues under the scope. He's not even qualified to certify cause of death. And so they tried to appoint someone over him, but he took them to court. This is back in the late 60s, I believe.
So well before?
Well before mine. So no one in the state can say, oh, we didn't know that this guy wasn't qualified. This was case law. So the state tried to appoint someone over him. He did them for constructive dismissal. And they buckled like a cheap suit, and he was allowed to stay in his position. So they said, we'll let you stay there on one condition. You get the requisite training. You get qualified. He never did. And so this dragged on and on and on. And meantime, he's still performing autopsies, still certifying bogus causes of death, and testifying in criminal cases and leading to convictions. There are at least 400 cases in where he testified in a criminal case that led to an outcome. Every one of those is up in the air. Every one of those is suspect at law.
Like the because I did, you know, law and we actually learned about him in criminal law about the case where, or sorry, maybe it was sentencing, the case where he made like. Oh, something ridiculous where the body type, it was an ectomorph. I think it was a robbery case, and he made a conclusion based on like the body type of the person.
That's one I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean,
or maybe actually I wasn't a very good student, so
some of the most absurd findings that this guy made, or declarations I should say, would be that there was a guy who had striations on his body,
mm-hmm.
and the guy was, because the guy was wearing corduroy, Manock said, well, he would, that they were the result of contact between his face and the corduroy trousers that he was wearing.
So he had worn his face
last... Just straight lines.
Okay.
But what it turned out
was... this a deceased person?
Deceased. What it turned out was this guy had been beaten with the threaded end of a steel pipe. You know how they sort of have nuts on the end of them?
Was this the young Aboriginal boy in the outback?
Is this Gerald Warren?
Yes.
And what had happened is after he'd been beaten, they then ran over him several times, forwards, backwards. Mm-hmm. And this clown said that the marks on the body between having been run over and struck with a bar were indistinguishable between that and having come into contact with corduroy clothing.
Right.
So he wasn't even prepared to admit he could have been mistaken. So he just...
He just made this stuff up. Like, he literally just made shit up.
On the spur of the moment.
And what... Or did we... Is there...
No one challenged him.
But has there ever been any, like... Did anybody even look into why this guy did this stuff? Was he crazy or was he...
I think he was a narcissist.
A narcissist, and... they're the most dangerous people.
Narcissists just tend to believe that they are more important than anybody else and they lack completely any empathy whatsoever. Psychopaths, I think, are potentially dangerous. And I think he was dangerous because of the fact that he didn't care what the consequences were of his bogus declarations. And I think part of the problem was, because he had been in operation for so long, the system, the state, realised that they got a problem here. If they suddenly lift the lid on this, every case that he's been involved in becomes subject to a new inquiry. And so that means loss of face, potentially getting ousted from government, but also the cost of having to potentially rerun at least some, if not all, of those trials.
Yeah, and the state doesn't want that because there's more money, there's more time, there's more effort, and ultimately, you know, the court system is already like it's
totally backed up.
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, I don't know in criminal, but I'm assuming it's similar. But I know in commercial, if you Supreme Court case or even a district court case, it's 12 months, you know, like from listing, like, you know, if you'd be lucky to get anything, maybe it's even more. Again, I wasn't a very good law student, but it's a ridiculously long time. Like, I mean, you know, if you've got an issue that you want to resolve, like, you just have to wait. And I assume, you know, like, I don't even want to think about how long was it in between, because at one point you got arrested, right?
Yeah.
Again, I haven't read this book yet. I apologize, Henry. I confessed to this before.
I signed it.
He signed it, and I confessed to this. I confessed to it before the interview. So I'm not lying.
I appreciate the honesty.
Yeah. Well, of course. You know, I've got like a slight case of ADD. So I'm not very good at, you know, as I said, wasn't a very good law student. Not very good at. But I've been good at making things happen. You know, like I can get a podcast. I can get a podcast off the ground, but I'm not very good at sitting down and doing one thing. So at one point, you obviously got arrested.
Yep.
You know, can you? You got arrested. How long was it between?
It was about 6 weeks afterwards.
Six weeks afterwards.
Because when my fiance Anna died. Everyone initially at that stage believed it was just, you know, a senseless, tragic accident.
Mm.
And it wasn't until this guy came along the scene that he decided that, well, no, I've got a theory, and he wanted to make the facts fit that theory.
Mm.
And so they launched sort of a campaign, and after 6 weeks, I found myself arrested, facing a murder trial. And naively at that stage, I believed, well, look, I believed in the system at that stage, and it was only a matter of time before either they'd come to their senses, the charges would be dropped, or if it ever came to it and I had to go to trial, well, the facts would speak for themselves.
Mm.
But naivety can only get you so far.
Yeah, no, and the justice system doesn't work.
No.
It's not common sense.
Well, the thing is, you know, my first trial ended in what they call a hung jury. They couldn't reach a unanimous decision. And because of that, I had to face a second trial. But what most people don't realise is that if your jury members can't even stay awake for the entire giving of evidence, that's actually tantamount to a mistrial. And three of my jurors were taking it in turns to fall asleep. I mean, admittedly, it was long, it was drawn out, very repetitive.
It is. And criminal trials are like that. Like it's,
they are.
I think we have to have a look at that as our justice system. You know, like, is that the best way to do it? Because, like, honestly, this is the reason I'm not working as a lawyer, because it literally is, like, insane. If you go into, like, a cross-examination,
yeah.
You know, even if it's a murder trial, which, you know, it is just like, so on.
Unfortunately.
And you know, Henry, I don't want this, you know, like, because obviously, like, it's you've got this crazy story, but, like, I think, you know, you as a person are very interesting, and I don't want this to be just a conversation about all that bullshit that happened, because, you know, is it hard for you to talk about it at this point, or have you processed it all?
It's not, actually, because, I believe I am truly, truly free, Victor, because of the simple fact that I have been able to let go of the anger and the bitterness that I held for quite a while. And, you know, if I still hung on to that, I would basically still be a prisoner of my emotions and my hatred and anger and unforgiveness, even though I might be walking around at large. Mm. You know, what would be the payoff there? I would not be happy. I would not be at peace, and I'd be a pain in the ass to be around. Fortunately, I'm certainly not the first to, and I hope I'm not the last one. But for me, you know, the real challenge was to not let the system grind me down. You know, when I say the system, whether it's the legal process and where it failed, or the correction system, which people think it's all geared towards rehabilitation, but it isn't. It's basically warehousing. That's all it is. It's bums on beds and just move you through the system so that you make some space for the next lot of people that will come through. And, you know, just jumping back to the point we were talking about with the jury system.
Yeah.
I would never ever, if I ever had to face another matter, I would never ever opt for trial by jury if it was serious or complicated or going to last for a long time, because juries are not trained in the law. They're not experienced in maintaining focus and attention for a long period of time. You know, life now is just becoming shorter and shorter in terms of sound bites.
Of course.
We can't handle long periods.
Well, I'm going to cut this. This interview is going to get cut down into 30 little bits and pieces and get posted, you know, little 15-second clips, because that's what, you know.
Exactly.
That's what it is. Yeah. You know,
it's got to captivate us. It's got to keep us interested and move along. So I would only ever opt, if it was in those three areas, for trial by judge. Most people don't know you have that option available to you. Because if you're not, you've also got the phenomenon that people will always, because we're human, we bring some baggage with us. If you haven't seen, look up a movie called 12 Angry Men and try and see the original one.
I have seen the
remake.
Black and White?
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, yeah.
Henry Fonda.
It's great, They're all in the room and...
Yeah.
And powerful.
Exactly.
Powerful.
And what it shows is that people are
20 seconds.
People are looking to punish previous offenders in their life, not the defendant in their case. And that is scary.
Yeah.
Truly scary.
Yeah. Well, we are back, Henry. So let me ask you a question. How did you manage to let go of the anger and those emotions, what we were talking about? Did you meditate, or what was your process?
Well, let me jump back a bit, if I may.
Please.
The trigger for it was the fact that I had reached a point where I had actually given up on getting out. I had to accept the very real possibility I was going to die in jail. I realised that the fight I was up against was not legal, it was political. And we just didn't have the firepower for that. And trying to get my head around the fact that I was going to die in jail was not an easy pill to swallow. In fact, I got so angry, I told my brothers, saying, when I die, you refuse to take my body, because I'm not going to have these bastards stick my family with the final insult of having the cost of a funeral as well. Now, that was a bit of a battle because they didn't want a bar of it. They said, you're not going to die in here. And I said, well, I am. You know, you have to admit that. I have, you do. And that made me a little bit user unfriendly. And whenever anybody brought the subject of appeals and that sort of stuff, I would shut them down. Sometimes a little bit brutally. You know, I wasn't violent or anything, but I just said, you know, I'm not interested, mate. You know, go away, shut up. And that meant, you know, I became sort of pretty much alone. I walked alone, I trained alone, I ate alone. I became almost, you know, a recluse. And I reached a point where I could see the pain in my family's eyes. Every time they came on a visit, you know, I'd shut them down whenever they started to talk about hope and all that sort of thing. And that was killing me. I could see the impact that was having on them. And, you know, that's not me. It wasn't who I wanted to be, and it had to stop. And I was lucky because, you know, I'm a voracious reader, and I read something like 3,500 books while I was away. And one of the books I read, it was saying that people and situations don't make you angry or upset. We choose to let them. And I thought, yeah, well, that sounds simple, doesn't it?
That's so true.
I know it's true, but how do you combat that?
It's that story that you tell yourself. That's what you were talking about when we were before the thing. And it's so easy.
We program ourselves, don't we?
And it's so easy, you know. And obviously, like, I understand it when you're saying this about being user unfriendly. I understand this on a deeper level, because I've gotten myself in ruts like that where, you know, obviously, and it's so silly because, you know, hearing your story just puts everything into perspective for me. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, I'm pissed off because I did a law degree and a law degree is a waste of time. You know, like what fucking ridiculous. Yeah. Like, how ridiculous is that compared to what you went through? Like, you know, it's nothing. Like,
right. It's all relative, isn't it?
It's all relative. Yeah. It's all relative.
So I think, okay, well, that sounds great. Sounds simple. But let's battle test it. So I did. I put it through its paces and I said, okay. The key was, whenever anyone brought up a subject, instead of just reacting, saying, oh, that's it, no more, I'm done.
Just shutting them down.
Shutting them down. I said, okay, Henry, don't react, act. Act. And that little mantra, just repeating yourself a couple of times.
Don't react,
was
act.
Was enough to stop me in the moment from just being a pain in the ass, from being obnoxious. So I thought, no. So I did that enough, and then it became reflex. It became my new default position. And so I said, "Yep, okay." And then I slowly but surely got back in control of my emotions. So instead of getting angry and pushing people away,
instead of your emotions controlling you,
exactly,
you began to control your emotions.
Yes, exactly. And there's so many of us who are like that.
Yes,
I mean, we can hang on to unforgiveness. Someone offends us in some way. They forget something, or they don't do what they promised to do. What do? We hold it against them forever.
Yeah.
Someone sort of cheats us. Do we ever forgive them? No. We hold it against them forever.
But who suffers? Who's holding that negative emotion?
Exactly. We are. Because we're giving them free rental space in our head. And where's the value in that?
And we have very limited brain power. That's what, you know, people don't understand that. And today's day and age, with the information overload that we've got, you can, like, there's infinite amount of shit you can land into your brain. Yep. But the trick is picking
pick the good stuff.
That's right. Yeah. What you're going to give. So what concrete techniques did you use?
Well, there was that physical break. You know, sort of. I practiced.
Was it a breakthrough? Was it like? Did you have a breakthrough moment where you were like, okay,
it was progressive. It was progressive.
It wasn't.
So it was that first reading to start with. So okay, I want to get back in control of me. I want to control my emotions, not the other way around. All right. So there was that. So then I actually had to put that principle into practice. Mm-hmm. And to do that, I had to operate that little mantra. So, okay, don't react, act. And that's where most of us sort of do ourselves an injustice.
Yeah.
Because we just lash back. If I push you, you'll push me back. And the more you push, the more I'll push back. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a no-win situation. We both lose. So by putting that brake on, that gives me the first advantage.
Yeah.
And then I can decide to either say something or not, to push back or not. And
you can think about the consequences of...
Exactly, because we're impulsive creatures.
We are.
And if we don't give ourselves time to weigh up the consequences, it's too late. It's done. It's a done deal. So there was that. And then the other thing that really helped was I read something by Nelson Mandela. And he said that hanging on to bitterness and anger is like drinking poison and waiting for it to kill your enemy. Again, like you said, who does that hurt?
Can you say that again?
Holding on to bitterness and anger is like drinking poison and waiting for it to kill your enemy.
That's powerful. That's so powerful, but it's so true.
It's eminent sense. I don't like the expression common sense because I don't believe it is, but it's good sense.
Yes.
It's golden wisdom.
Yes.
And when you have that, when I had that on top of that other realization that I could choose to be in control and act, not just react, be at the whim of my emotions and my feelings, that gave me the power back. And I figured, you know, most of the time I'm holding offense against someone else, whether it was the system, another prisoner, or some person outside, a journalist. They don't know that I'm angry. My anger doesn't affect them. It's eating me up and it's harming the people around me. Crazy. And it makes no sense.
And it pushes the people that you do care about, the people that didn't do anything wrong, because you're not pushing the Attorney General away.
No,
he's not trying to visit you. He's not spending time with you.
Just a name or a statistic.
He doesn't care. Like, you know, he doesn't care about you as Henry Keogh. You're pushing the people that are coming to visit you, and that are, you know, they are doing everything they can in the power to try and ultimately, you know, you're here.
Yeah.
You're here. Your prison term would, you know, you would still be in prison.
Yeah. Exactly.
If it didn't work out, and I guarantee you, what I think is more, and I think you will agree with this, that if you didn't have this mind shift, it wouldn't have been possible.
Oh, hell no.
You would have stayed in there.
100%.
You would have stayed in there.
Yeah.
Exactly. Have you, because you mentioned Nelson Mandela, and obviously do you feel a sense of connection because of that wrongful imprisonment that he suffered through. Have you heard of Viktor Frankl? Have you read Viktor Frankl?
I've read it about 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, the meaning
of life, Man's Search for Meaning.
The Man's Search for Meaning. Did you read that while you were inside?
I had actually read it before I went to prison, and I'd read it twice during prison, and another time post release.
I thought that was a very powerful book for me.
Brilliant.
Very, very powerful.
And what he showed was that, you know, if we have something to live for, if we have some vestige, no matter how small it is, if we have something to look forward to, it's enough to hang on to tenuously or as vigorously as we can, to hope and for life.
Mm-hmm.
Because he found
that... And that's who survives.
That's right. Because he found that people in the death camps in Germany fell into two groups. Those that had something to hope for, i.e. Being reunited with their loved ones after the war, and those who didn't. And those that didn't just gave up and either died through lack of hope and malnutrition, or they hung themselves. Those that had some hope, they survived. The majority of them survived.
Mm.
And they still had, you know, healthy, normal lives afterwards.
Yeah, just like you do.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that your life, like, are you because you're obviously happy. You know, you're a happy person.
I am. Yeah.
And your life is going good. Like, you've got a good life, right? Is that how you feel?
I do. Look, it might sound crazy, but and I've been asked this question: what would my life have been like if I hadn't been where I was for 20 years? And I said, you know, the answer was, and it just came out of the blue, I said, it would have been vanilla. And they said, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, look, I've had experiences that most people wouldn't even dream of.
Mm.
I've met people most people will never come across in their life.
Mm.
Some people probably wouldn't want to. But the experience has made me tougher, it's stronger, and, you know, the best part, it's made me a better person than the one that went in. Now, with all of that, what's not to celebrate? And, you know, I just wish it had been a hell of a lot shorter.
Yeah,
but
of course.
I don't resent the experience because it's been the making of me. It's been a transformation.
You can't wish, but you can't change a lot
to be grateful for.
Yeah.
A lot to be grateful for.
Yeah.
You know, I had people, you know, all my family, and they stood by me. There was a whole raft of people who I didn't know beforehand, who wanted to join the campaign to sort of have my case reviewed, because they saw an injustice. So they weren't motivated by love family love or this love of me as a mate or as a person, they just saw an injustice and they were outraged by it and they wanted to do it. Now, how many people have got that sort of fortune on their side? And these people actually stood the test of time. They weren't in it just for, you know, 6 months, a couple of years. Some of them were in it for 12, 14 or more years.
My mum's a social worker, and you know, and the statistics, you know, like the re-incarceration rate, almost certain didn't pronounce that correctly, yeah, but yeah, yeah. The amount of people that...
They're way too high.
Yeah.
We don't have...
There is no rehabilitation, like no, you said. It's no. A warehousing system, like, yeah, and it's a very expensive warehousing system.
They estimate it's between $90,000 and $100,000 a year to house a prisoner, which is crazy.
$90,000 to $100,000. Why not give him a job digging a goddamn, like, making roads, even if it was just making roads. But of course,
that's not the way it goes. I mean, crime is meant to be punitive, not just rehabilitative.
Yeah.
And therein lies part of the problem too, because that balance, that equation gets out of balance rather. And
right, because politicians, it's the best campaigning tactic.
Yeah, yeah. Tough on crime.
Yeah. Yeah.
That awful phrase, rack 'em, stack 'em and pack 'em. I mean, the guy that came up with that should have a dose of his own medicine and see what the consequences were. I read an interesting book whilst I was away. It's called Crime Against the Future. And it was looking at incarceration rates across all sorts of countries. You know, the USSR, China, Australia, UK, America. And America has got one of the highest incarceration rates, if not the highest now, in the world.
Something like 2-3 million Americans are in prison.
It's appalling. And the majority of those are the disadvantaged Afro-Americans, because they can't afford good legal representation, and they're just up against it. And so, and of course, you've also got the private prison system over there.
Which is outrageous.
Not only that.
For-profit prisons.
They have... prison conglomerates over there who will actually sue the state if they don't have if they don't meet their target numbers for prisoners for them to house. So it's all driven by money. Now
a private prison suing the state because there's not enough prisons, isn't the point of prisons to be empty? I mean, ultimately,
ideally,
prisons would be empty.
Yeah. And so the point of that book was that by incarcerating people unjustly and unnecessarily, instead of giving them alternatives and also making sure that you have the right person that's being charged, means that it's costing society more now. As you said very early in the piece, go in with a bachelor, you come out with a master's or a PhD, you know, all you're doing is increasing the amount of antipathy towards society, the animosity and anger that gets acted out, if not necessarily against society, against families. I mean, look at domestic violence that's on the increase. Look at the amount of alcoholism and drug abuse that people are turning to as a way of self-medicating. You know, society is going to hell in a handbasket primarily because we're not addressing the key issues that face us.
We're not. And the drug abuse thing is really major, isn't it? I mean, my age bracket, you know, we are like a depressed, you know, society as a whole. And I mean, I think there's just so many underlying issues and none of them are being addressed, you know, like the drug abuse and you know, both subscription and legal. And that's just, it's just getting worse and worse. And, you know, suicide rates are going up. And how do you see any solutions?
There are more moving parts in this than I can count, and the only way you can really do it is to look at where are the areas that you can make the biggest possible change, the biggest positive change, and attack that one first, and therefore then let the rest cascade down, because we'll never ever, I don't believe, fix that problem wholly, because it's
what,
just
the problem
of sort of people feeling disenfranchised, alienated from society. As human beings, we're not taught some really key skills right from the get-go. We're not taught how to pick a life partner.
would have taught how to handle conflict or negotiate differences in life, let alone in a relationship. Would have taught how to do one of the most important things in life, and that's to raise another human being.
Mm.
Yeah, we do it by trial and error, and mostly error.
Mm.
If we get it right, it's probably more accident than design. Mm. And as a result, because we make so many stuff-ups, and because we're all different in terms of the damage or the impact that that will have on us, people can be walking wounded and not know it until sometime down later. Something will trigger something, memory in them, and they'll act out and then find themselves in court. Or they'll act out and lash out and hurt someone. And then you have someone who's damaged or injured for life, or worse, killed. So the consequences are myriad. And therefore, what we have to do is go back and look at the key fundamental elements that hold us together as decent, functioning human beings. And look at preventing the problems rather than just trying to fix it up after the event. It's not going to be a quick fix, but it's a fix that if we approach it from a number of angles, right, sure, we try and fix up what's already in train and damaged, try and arrest, in the right word, sense of the word, prevent those who are in the early stages of hurt and damage from going on and not being treated, address those as well. But also look at the front end, what feeds the whole system of problems. And go back to the schools, go back to the parenting, so that we have the requisite skills.
The education system, I think it's
so. Education, but also educate the parents, because parents shouldn't abdicate all their responsibility and throw it back on the education system, because all of us have a part to play. There was an old saying, it takes a whole village to raise a human being.
Mm.
And we forget that.
Mm.
And we've lost that collaboration.
We've
lost that spirit of joint effort.
We're a completely individualistic society now. That's why people are so disconnected, because you work alone, you live alone, we're so connected all the time, but you're not.
Exactly.
We're not connected.
Digitally connected, but not connected with the soul, but connected with the heart.
Mm. So you think education is a big part of the problem?
Of course it is.
I agree.
Yeah. And public dialogue. That's part of the reason why I agreed to be on this.
Because
there are so many issues that assail us. Because right now, most of us are grappling to understand where we are, what is our role in life, what is our role in society. Men are struggling to know, do I sort of open the door or don't I? How masculine should I be? How in touch
with my poison masculinity, or is chivalry dead? You can't
political correct political sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We're pulled every which way
in
terms of what is the new norm? What is acceptable? And unless we keep the dialogue open and don't get howled down by people saying, oh, that's not PC or whatever, we have to keep dialogue open.
Yeah.
We talk about it being a democracy, and democracy is the lifeblood of democracy should be free speech, not necessarily hate speech, but free speech,
of course, you're
at liberty to express your opinion.
That's right.
And have active and vibrant discourse and debate.
Debate.
That's healthy.
Debate. That's healthy. It's such an important word. And now it's like, people just make up their mind. And it's because there is this...
It's all absolute, isn't it?
It's all absolute. And I think our cultural war in Australia isn't as pronounced as it is in the United States, perhaps because we're not as politically active here. Like, people just don't care, whatever, mate. Everybody here is so chilled out, which is great. This is what I love. We're all Australian, and we love it. It's great, but it is, in a sense, we're so
Like, we just don't care. Like, I mean, I actually just went, like, Jesus, I can count the conversation I had about the election on one hand, you know, like, because people don't care, you know, it's not a big issue here. So I think that cultural war here isn't as big as it is in the US, but it still is. Like, we still have got this left and right, and people have just made their mind up, you know. It's like, there isn't, you know, like, some, like, you know, people on the left think, you know, whatever, there's as many genders as people want, and people on the right are, you know, no, not at all. And the mind's made up. Same with, you know, some people climate change, or people with, like, veganism, you know, some people are like veganism hater, other people's like veganism save humanity, you know, and the minds are made up. And I think and how do we get people to talk again, to listen
and
to
respect, you know, someone else's opinion? You're allowed to have an opinion. People seem to feel threatened if others don't agree with your opinion. You know, one of the real things that helped me reassume my position in society was I was freed from worrying about what other people thought about me or what they might say, because I came to the realization that it's only an opinion, it's only what they think, it's not right, it may not even be factual, and so why let it bother me? If I'm never going to see them or hear them again, why let it play on my mind? And we let those little things take too large a proportion, too large a space in our head. It's not necessary.
It's not.
And you know, you might think a certain thing about me. That's great, right? Let's talk about it. And if I can modify that by discussion, great. If I can't, that's fine. Right? I might think things about you. And until you demonstrate by what you say or what you do, I'm probably going to hold that position until I have evidence that's going to cause me to change it. But most of us aren't open to that change, even with the evidence that we see and hear, which I think is a shame.
It is a psychological bias, because we're programmed to, you know, it's like a survival tactic. Like, our brain doesn't want to, like, keep. But I find the more intelligent the person, not necessarily IQ, because I think IQ is a bad measurement.
Bad.
Just because somebody can calculate things really well and can do, you know, abstract things in their mind, it's not a very good, for me, it's not a very good measurement of intelligence.
No.
But I think, like, the wiser the person, the more willing, you know, the smartest people I know in my life, and again, I use the word smart,
EQ,
you know,
EQ,
EQ yeah. just, but you do need a bit of IQ, you know,
yeah,
but,
sure.
but when I say smart, I mean somebody that's got it all, that's got, like, a well-rounded, they are, like, you know, when they hear things, they're like, okay.
They're self-aware. We don't listen.
And that's why they got to where they are. That's why they are successful, because they listen and they take new ideas on board, which then allows them to grow. Because if you stuck in the same box that you've been in your whole life, then, you know, you can't, how are you going to ever grow to the next level? And people are very closed-minded. They don't realize that, like, you can just keep growing and growing and growing. Like, they're like, yeah, you know, this is me now, I've got my picket fence and my you know, car, and that's it. But, like, there's so much more.
Express your opinion.
That's right.
And have active and vibrant discourse and debate.
Debate.
That's healthy.
Debate. That's
healthy.
Right. It's such an important word. And now it's like, you know, people just make up their mind. And it's because there is this...
It's all absolute, isn't it?
It's all absolute. And, like, you know, I think our cultural war in Australia isn't as pronounced as it is in the United States, perhaps because we're not as politically active here. Like, people just don't care, you know, like, yeah, whatever, mate, like, have a, you know, everybody here is so chilled out, which is great, you know, this is what I love, you know, we're all Australian, you know, like, and we love it, it's great, but it is, in a sense, like, we're so, like, we just don't care. Like, I mean, the election just went, like, Jesus, I can count the conversation I had about the election on one hand, you know, like, because people don't care, you know, it's not a big issue here. So I think that cultural war here isn't as as big as it is in the US, but it still is. Like, we still have got this left and right, and people have just made their mind up. You know, it's like there isn't, you know, like some, like, you know, people on the left think, you know, whatever, there's as many genders as people want, and people on the right are, you know, no, not at all. And the mind's made up. Same with, you know, some people with climate change, or people with like veganism. You know, some people are like veganism, hate them. Other people's like veganism, save humanity. You know, and the minds are made up.
Yeah.
And I think and like, how do we get people to talk again, to listen
and
to the others?
Respect someone else's opinion.
Mm.
You're allowed to have an opinion. People seem to feel threatened if others don't agree with their opinion. You know, one of the real things that helped me, reassume my position in society, was I was freed from worrying about what other people thought about me or what they might say, because I came to the realization that it's only an opinion, it's only what they think, it's not right, it may not even be factual, and so why let it bother me? If I'm never going to see them or hear them again, why let it play on my mind? And we let those little things take too large a proportion, too large a space in their head. It's not necessary.
It's not.
And you know, you might think a certain thing about me. That's great, right? Let's talk about it. And if I can modify that by discussion with you, great. If I can't, that's fine. Right? I might think things about you. And until you demonstrate by what you say or what you do, you know, I'm probably going to hold that position until I have evidence that's going to cause me to change it. But most of us aren't open to that change, even with the evidence that we see and hear, which I think is a shame.
It is a psychological bias, because we're programmed to, you know, it's like a survival tactic. Like, our brain doesn't want to like keep. But I find the more intelligent the person, not necessarily IQ, because I think IQ is a bad measurement.
Yeah, it's a bad measurement.
Just because somebody can calculate things really well and can do, you know, abstract things in their mind, is not a very good, for me, it's not a very good measurement of intelligence.
No.
But I think, like, the wiser the person, the more willing, you know, the smartest people I know in my life, and again, I use the word smart,
EQ,
you know,
EQ, they call it now,
EQ, just, but you do need a bit of IQ, you know,
yeah,
but,
sure.
But when I say smart, I mean somebody that's got it all, that's got like a well-rounded, they are, like, you know, when they hear things, they're like, okay.
They're self-aware. We don't listen.
And that's why they got to where they are. That's why they are successful, because they listen and they take new ideas on board, which then allows them to grow. Because if you're stuck in the same box that you've been in your whole life, then, you know, you can't, how are you going to ever grow to the next level? And people are very closed-minded. They don't realize that, like, you can just keep growing and growing and growing. Like, they're like, yep, you know, this is me now, I've got my picket fence and my you know, car, and that's it. But like, there is so much more, but people aren't.
Yeah, I have a very positive outlook on what people are capable of. And I like to think that there are very, very few exceptions or instances where people are not capable of change or redemption. And one of my favorite stories from inside is that, I mean, I was standing in a queue waiting for the phone. And you gotta remember that in jail, there might be one or two phones for 30 to 40 people to share. So and you get about 10 to 15 minutes, and if you don't get through, you're at the back of the line. And so while I was waiting in the queue, Tomo, a guy I knew, who'd been in and out since he was about 14. He started his career in juvie, and he progressed through petty crime, in and out. He's doing what we call the life sentence on installment plan, basically. And he'd only been out for 4 Christmases, and never one of them back to back. So he'd always...
Wow. And how old was he at this?
He'd done 24, so he would have been about 38.
Wow.
And he looked at... He said,
so what did he keep getting looked up for? Petty stuff.
I'm coming to that.
Yeah,
He had nothing to fall back on, no skills, etc. And he said, what do you want? I said, what do you mean, what do I want? He said, well, you must be on something. You're too chilled. I mean, you're a lifer. I mean, you're not getting out of here, are you, man? I said, well, that's true. And he said, so how do you do it? And I said, well, I've learned the art of letting go. some things you can't change in life, so you have to let go of what you can't change. And he said, you know, I wish I could do that, because, you know, outside of jail, I've got nothing. And outside of jail, I am nothing. You know, he had a bit of a name inside, but that was it. And he said, you know, I am sick of it. You know, I'm done. I want to stop it. You know, he didn't know his kids. You know, they didn't know him. And he said, I'm done, man. I said, well, if you're serious, I thought as I was saying it, I sounded like Andy Dufresne. I said, well, if you're serious, I'll show you how to do it. And to his credit, he and a couple of his mates, we sat aside a few times, and I just explained what I've been through with you. And they started applying it. And they've actually been out now, all of them, all three of them, for 5 years in a row, and all the days in between.
Mm.
And so what that proves to me is, if it can happen in a hostile and unsupportive environment like prison, it can happen anywhere. So all you've got to do is want it, and then have the mechanism or the structure, the method, to make it happen. So I like to think that that is probably one of the best stories to show what's possible if you set your mind to it. And you know, he had great motivation and a simple system to put into place. And
what was the system?
It doesn't have to be any more complicated than that.
What was the system?
Oh, the system was what I showed before, about sort of putting a brake.
Yep.
Don't be reactive.
Yes. Yes. Act, yes. You know, take control of your life.
Exactly. Simple as that. Sorry.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Problem with that. The word system. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if somebody finds themselves in your situation,
yeah,
in the situation where you're incarcerated.
Yep.
And you're locked up, and you know it's scary. There is no tutorial. You don't go through now this happens. It's like a big unknown. The system's complicated.
Yep.
Do you have any advice? Do you have anything that you want to share about that?
Well, the first thing is that you are a fish out of water. You really are. You don't know what the rules are. There's two sets of rules. You have the official prison rules, and you've got the unwritten prison's rules. And what you may not know is that the second lot are what probably will determine how long or even how well you survive.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to find out what they are. And the best way to do that is just to keep your mouth closed,
mm-hmm.
and your eyes and your ears open, and just watch and listen. See how people are interacting, see what they're not doing, and see what the consequences of them acting or talking in a certain way are. So that will give you your first lot of information. Don't overshare. Never ask questions that are off limits. So you don't go running around asking.
This could go for like life in general, but stakes just aren't as high in.
Oh yeah, this is the pointy end. So you don't run around asking people, you know, what they're in for, or how long they've done.
It's not a question you ask what you're in for?
No. No.
It's something that people share, like, once
if they want to share it, fine.
Yeah.
But you don't probe unless you know them, particularly if they're strangers.
Wow.
And, you know, you never ever betray a confidence. If someone tells you something, you don't repeat it to anybody, not a soul. Don't even talk about it in your sleep, because you never know who they know. And if it gets back that you've, you know, betrayed them in some way, you'll never ever regain their trust. Don't gamble. Don't buy anything in jail, like whether it's clothing, food, or toiletries, or even drugs, or play cards with money you haven't got.
Mm.
Because if you don't, you will find yourself in a world of trouble.
Yeah.
Be circumspect about what you tell people. You don't have to tell everyone your life story. Earn people's trust and make them earn yours. Don't just give away your trust casually, because it might come back to bite you in the ass.
If you want to promote anything, if it's anything you want to talk about, that sense, you know, feel free to do it. Otherwise, we'll just sort of let's, if there's anything that you want to talk about that we haven't mentioned already, now's the time. And like I said to you before this, you know, your story is not something that we can contain in an hour, in an hour long format. So hopefully we'll have you on here again and we can delve deeper into, because I think we really skimmed the surface, you know, like really, like when you think about it, we didn't even skim the surface of your actual case, you know, like there's four books written about you
at least four books,
countless television programs, you know, there's a lot. There's a lot to cover.
I mean, I like to support people that have supported me, so anybody that is watching this, share it, relay it, and you know, sort of, because I mean, this is a solid guy, he's genuine, and there aren't many authentic people around, so I believe in sort of promoting those that are the real deal.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Another solid guy too would be Ruben Dubrow. So watch the Dubrow Show. Give that a check. He's sort of crossing the board, and you know, he's trying to keep like this conversations real and pertinent to the male issues, because it's an area that's tended to be neglected for a long time, right? Bob Moles,
of course.
Get onto netk.k. netk.net.au, and just look at some of the cases that he's getting involved in, because without support from the general populace, he's not going to go anywhere. That's politicians right. only listen to a clamour, and unless there is a clamour from a group of voices, no one's going to be disturbed in.
And we need people like Bob Moles, who we haven't really touched on, but Bob Moles was very important in the legal process and in the key in overturning and actually, you know, the appeals, and it was going to the Attorney General and the Governor General. Was it going to the Governor at all? Did you file a petition?
We filed a number of petitions, but that's another story.
Because it's called a petition for mercy.
Because I mean, in my case too, they kept information hidden for nearly 10 years.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. They did. They
we'll come out on another show.
Which we're not going to mention any names. Yeah.
We'll keep the names confidential to protect the guilty. I think last but not least would be Graham Archer, who has written a book on my case. But
could you say that name again?
Graham Archer.
Graham
he
Archer.
He was a program manager for Today Tonight.
Yeah.
They were behind my case for nearly 14 years, and so had they not continued to carry that baton for as long as they did, the case just would have fizzled out.
Yeah.
Graham wrote a book called Unmaking a Murder, which was this it's brilliant play on the Netflix series Making a Murder.
Yes,
and he actually won a Ned Kelly award, which is the highest accolade you can get for true crime.
Yeah.
Only last year. And we're going to first book.
We're going to link all the books that you're mentioning. We're going to link them on the Absolute Gentleman website. So all of that for the listeners, they'll be able to look at Bob's website and look at the books that you've mentioned, and anything else. If we did forget it, we'll be able to sort of we'll put it on there as well.
Yeah.
Now I have one last question for you.
Sure.
What, you know, what's the craziest story? Like you know, like we've got
craziest story
from either from inside or not from inside, but like if you have like, what do you have, anything that's like, you know, like, or the scariest, like did you ever get into trouble, you know what I mean, like I want something juicy.
Oh yeah, okay. One of my craziest stories was I hate bullies with a passion.
Yes.
I think they're gutless. And I don't like them at all, because they just prey on the weak and the defenseless. But by the same token, I love reading and I love watching films.
Mm.
And so I collect expressions or sayings from movies and from books. And we had this guy who was just basically a thug. He just lobbed into the unit, and he's working his way around over a period of days, going cell by cell by cell, walking in. I mean, he was a big guy. He was built like Shrek. He was a monstrous. You know? The only thing different was skin colour, and his ears weren't trumpet shaped. But you know, seriously,
was he fat?
He was massive. No, he was solid.
Oh, like solid. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Young dude, but monstrous. And he'd go in and come out loaded up with toiletries, food.
Stealing it, we're just taking it.
No, liberating.
Liberating, yeah, liberating, yeah, right, yeah, okay.
Would be
yes.
How he would phrase it.
Yeah, yeah.
Or taxing.
Taxing, yeah.
And wait till this clown comes to my house, myself. So anyway, I was writing a letter, and he comes in, so I just looked back and I was ignoring him. And he comes in, and I said, "You're in the wrong house, mate. Piss off." So I got up and I said, and I had to look up like this. I said, "You clearly don't know who I am." He says, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Look, I'm a lifer, mate. I have nothing to lose. I'm not getting out." And you've got to remember that in jail, most of the conversation and dialogue is fairly limited. So they tend to talk in the same habituated patterns. And usually they say stuff like, "Well, shut up, mate, or I'll cave your head in." Well, I wanted something a little bit more graphic, something a little bit more disruptive and cutthroat.
Yeah, you wanted to add a bit of flair.
So I grabbed something either from, I can't remember, it was Goodfellas or The Godfather. And I said, "Mate, you screw with me and I will gut you like a fish." "Whoa, take it easy, mate, take it easy." And I don't know where it came from, it just dropped in. And he goes, "Take it easy, mate, I don't want any trouble." I said, "Well, you came to the wrong place, didn't you?" So I just walked past him, walked out of my cell, made myself a cup of coffee. And you've got to remember, in jail, there's very little to do. And most of the time, blokes are sitting around hoping something exciting happens. So
they see
this big guy walk into my cell, and I walk out, no lumps, bumps, or blood. And he comes out behind me, nothing in his arms. And they're all thinking, what's the go here? And I knew well enough not to put him on show by sort of talking it up or anything like that, so I just let it go. And I could see him brooding for about a day. And eventually he came up to me and said, "Oh, here we go." So I'm wondering which way I've got to duck, down or sideways or what.
Slip him and then come up with a
exactly.
Come up with a hook, yeah.
And if only. He said, "No one's ever spoken to me like that."
Yeah.
"No one speaks to me like that." I thought, here we go. So I'm watching his hands to see which one's going to come out and slap me. And he says, "I'm impressed." And he stuck his hand out.
That's what you got to do. That's what
and
you
that reinforced for
that's
me.
That's crazy.
I know. And I'm thinking, oh, I've dodged a bullet. But it reinforced for me.
You had the poker face the whole time.
Oh, yeah. Of course, you had to. Yeah, I played a role. And that most bullies are cowards. And if you stand up to them, then most of them will just melt away and they'll seek an easier target.
Mm.
And the other thing too, of course, is that I stood my ground.
You have to in life.
You have to in life. It doesn't have to be that dramatic or that potentially that dangerous.
Of course.
But just taking a stand, and you'll find that more people will respect you. And that's what's more important. If people respect you rather than just like you, they're more likely to stand beside you or behind you. That's my crazy story.
Henry, thank you so much. I'm really glad to... I'm thankful that you came on and spoke to me and that you shared your wisdom, and I feel very privileged for having had spoken to you and for you to coming on the first episode of the Absolute Gentleman on the Absolute Gentleman podcast, and I look forward to speaking to you again. Thank you very much, Henry. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Awesome.